more work. However, there were times when your reasoning was bad. There were times when you used verses that absolutely didn't prove the point. An example. One comment was, the people who did the new demonology sometimes didn't appear to talk to the people who did demonology, because the demonology taught straight new demonology, and it was like, wow, guys. But here is an example of what I mean by looking at verses. Several people wanted to say that demons are connected with two things. They're the cause of idolatry, and they're the cause of immorality and perversion. The verse that was used to support this were verses dealing with Mary Magdalene. Okay? Now, do you know why the New Demonology uses those verses? Because they connect Mary Magdalene both, as the scripture said, that demons were cast out of her, and they feel she was the woman who was taken in adultery. There is not a shred of evidence that Mary Magdalene is a woman taken in adultery. But they make those two connections, and they say, they make another leap of faith, I should say, or lack of faith, which says that if Mary Magdalene had seven demons, and she was a woman taken in adultery, then the demons must have caused her adultery. And therefore, demons cause sexual perversion. Guys, I can't tell you how many ways wrong that is. Adultery is a sin, but it's not perversion. Okay? Second, Mary Magdalene was not the woman taken in adultery. Third, where do this fornication and adultery come from? According to the Bible. Pardon? Okay, let's go to Galatians chapter 5. Finally, Jared, maybe not your paper. I'm going to talk to you then. That's not you. So you guys are more important here. Galatians 5. Verse 19. Where are we? Would you guys start in the back? Did not open the Bible. Galatians 5:19. That's why I call out the people in the back sometimes. Plus, everybody gets to hear their voices. But sometimes I suspect the people in the back are not always opening their Bibles. They don't think that I usually sit in the back. The only ones that are, they don't think their teachers ever did the things they did. Man, oh man, oh man. They don't think their teachers recognize snow when they see it. You know? Wow. You never heard some of your teachers preach. You don't suspect that God is born with a shovel. You know? Just shoveling the snow. And then if they go, my teachers won't recognize snow. Oh, come on now. You know? Not a thing you've done that your teachers haven't done better than you. Verse 19.
The acts of sinful nature are obvious.
Okay. Is that the NIV?
Yes.
Okay. I need somebody with New American Standard, New King James. See, what the NIV does is it translates one word, sinful nature. That is not a bad translation. It's just inaccurate. So, does anybody back there have NASB, NEV, New King James, King James, any other translation? Yes.
Now the deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, and
okay, murder. Let's go with the first three. The deeds of the flesh are adultery. What are they? Keep going. What was your list?
Immorality, impurity, sensuality.
Immorality, impurity, sensuality. Those aren't the deeds of demons. These are believers he's talking to. Demons are not the cause of immorality. Do you understand that? It's not like, you know, I'm doing all kinds of weird things, and therefore there's a demon I've got to get rid of. Now, please understand, you've got two extremes to avoid. The one extreme is acting like Satan's activities and demons are no concern to me, and I don't need to worry about God. Wow, don't go there. Paul wouldn't warn you about that. But you cannot connect sins in the life of a believer with demons. The technical theological word for that is nonsense. All right? And that, by the way, the NIV uses sin nature there. I like the word flesh. Sin nature is an interpretive decision. That's why you won't find any other Bible. By the way, when you're comparing translations, if your Bible has a translation that no other translation has, then you need to say, maybe it's not as, in this area, maybe it's not as reliable. So, I'm trying to tell you, and by the way, idolatry, read after sensuality. What's the next list?
Idolatry, sorcery, enmities.
Okay, idolatry and sorcery. They're not the work of demons. They're the work of the flesh. They're deeds of the flesh. When you come to the new demonology, I was hoping somebody might catch this. But it's not the kind of thing you read about, so it's the kind of thing we teach about. One of the problems with the new demonology that most of you picked up on was wrong things attributed to demons. But especially, one of the great errors is they replace the very consistent, thoroughgoing doctrine of sanctification, which is mortifying indwelling sin, saying, I'm going to put to death the deeds of the flesh. That's what Paul teaches. Throughout all of Paul's epistles, he teaches that. He says of them that you've got to put to death these. It's not a case that demons put thoughts in your mind. It's a case that you have a sinful principle inside of you. What do demons do? They present you with temptation from the outside. That's what they do. Just what Satan does. They present temptation outside. And how does the Bible say in James sin occurs? Many of you put this down. What causes sin? In James chapter 1.
The desires that battle within
you. The desires inside of you reach out on that temptation and pull it into you. The sinful thoughts, lusts, desires, the flesh reaches out, sees that temptation, and pulls it in. Then you think about it. Then you choose it. Then you act upon it. Then the affections, evil affections follow. That's where sin comes from. If you don't know that, here's the problem. I want us to be looking in these last 2 weeks, what is sound doctrine and what are the factors that make doctrine weak and poor. But here is the point I want you to understand. Weak doctrine damages believers in the church. If you have the doctrine that sins, especially habitual sins, come from demons, what will happen when people come to you for counseling and say, I'm having a drinking problem? I'm undergoing depression. What happens? You guys are in college. How many guys in college are struggling with sin problems or pornography or something? 90% maybe? Maybe more? See what I'm trying to say? When people come to you for counseling, what have you done in your life to deal with these? And somebody comes to you and says, that's a demon. Guess what? That's like somebody coming to you with their hair on fire and you saying you got an attitude problem. That's like coming to you with somebody who's got a big, huge chunk of wood sticking out of his back. And you say, what seems to be the problem? You know, you're not going to help that person. If you go to a doctor, and you go to a doctor with a broken arm, and the doctor says, I think there's something wrong with your hand. Your fingers don't seem to be working. Well, it's because the bone is broken right here. No, your fingers aren't working. Misdiagnosis will cause the problem to get worse. Even worse than that, Doctrine builds. We've been trying to show you this. Doctrine builds by our boxes. We started with the church, and then we went to the doctrine of biblical authority. We built. When you have fundamental errors at the base of your doctrine, the farther you go, the worse your doctrine gets. So this new demonology is very destructive because it's taking the major emphases of the Bible and turning them upside down, removing them, and replacing them. You will see that people who teach the new demonology, in fact, you question whether they actually believe that Christians have a sin nature. You question that because you see no emphasis whatsoever.
Just a question with the notes on the screen.
Yes.
We never got the word three.
Yes, I know that.
Okay.
I'm going through problems. I want to hit this one,
okay,
and then we'll come back. Yes.
Would you say that the foundation for new demonology is experience?
Oh, I think there are several foundations. One is experience. Two, it's phenomenalism. In other words, you look at the phenomena and you judge that instead of taking doctrine to the phenomena. So experience means what happens to me. Phenomenalism is judging somebody else's experience based upon what you see instead of the Bible. You see the difference? Experientialism is saying, it happened to me, therefore, I know it's true. Phenomenalism is looking at something and saying, hey, I see that happening, this is what I think it is, instead of saying, let me look at that and sift it through the grid of the scripture. So yes, it's true in both ways.
Because like, the emerging church would be the same problem as far as...
Oh, emerging church is worse. They don't believe in doctrine. They do not believe in the whole practice of doctrine. The emergent church teaches the doctrine of putting God in a box. Have you ever heard that phrase? Here? Nonsense. I'm sorry. I'm teaching the doctrine of the church. What we teach in here is doctrine. What you get out there is theory. Okay? I'm telling you that's the way it is. Those are the words of the president. You take your doctrine of the church from ecclesiology. Everything else follows. But the emergent church, we're going to see, they don't believe in doctrine. They believe that when you say something is true, that's only true for you in your language and your time and your space, and you can't say that there's no such thing as universal truth. It does not exist. And for you to say something is right and to say something else is wrong, that's colonialism. That's imperialism. That's the root of all of our problems, people thinking they're right. Doctrine isn't what you know, it's who you know.
So how do you teach the proper epistemology to your church? Then?
With the emergent church?
With the emergent church?
That is what Scott is trying to say. Their epistemology is totally wrong. You will not get sound doctrine in the emergent church because epistemology is how do I know what I know? How do I know that I know something? And their doctrine of epistemology is completely unbiblical. Absolutely. They don't believe in biblical authority. So that's a problem. Here, again, when you look at the new demonology and you look at just this one area. Now, what happens here? The Old Testament definitely connects idolatry with demons. There's definitely a connection. The problem you have is failure to look at what's really going on. Just because demons are associated with idols, does that mean that every idol is a demon? What did Paul say about idols in 1 Corinthians? I know that an idol is what? Okay. 1 Corinthians. Sometimes when I've studied something, I assume everybody else has studied it to the same degree. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and let me see if I can find it here. Verse 19 and 20. Who's next to read? Yes.
What do I mean there? That if they sacrifice to idols anything, or that an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things that the Gentiles sacrifice, the sacrifice of Jesus and not to God.
Okay. The point is, he says, I'm not saying an idol is anything. It's nothing. There is no demon entity behind it. The point is, the people who sacrifice think there is. And that's the whole point of 1 Corinthians. They think there's something behind it. That was their intention. So how in the world do you want to associate yourself with something that people have associated with demons? That verse is the key to understanding that entire passage. When you were, turn your section on demonology. Under names of demons. Eli-Lee. What does Eli-Lee mean? What was your definition of Eli-Lee? Those of you who define... And by the way, you see the comments on mostly things that are wrong. I didn't bother commenting on things that were right. Okay, so there's a lot of good stuff, but you don't learn by me saying, that's right, that's right, that's right, that's right. And this is a learning exercise. Eli-Lee, definitions. Emptiness. What does emptiness mean? One of the words for demon, Eli-Lee, means empty, which means nothing there. The demons are promoting worship of something that is not there. The new demonology teaches every pagan god is really a demon. So every time a person worships a pagan god, there's demon involvement. Every single time. That means every Buddhist is involved with worship of demons. Every Hindu is involved with worship of demons. That means every Greek who believed in their gods, every Roman was involved in demon worship. Do you see the problem here? They take and they misunderstand the relationship. Demons promote idolatry. They certainly do. In the tribulation, Satan promotes the worship of one of the two beasts. Correct? Satan promotes the worship of one of those two. So he definitely promotes idolatry. But that's not the point. There's a difference between them advocating idolatry and every idol being a demon. You can't do that. And so we step beyond the bounds of what the Bible says. Part of the problem was you came to the books before you knew doctrine and not afterwards. That's the problem with this assignment. You get your information from the books, then you form your doctrine, but you don't go back to the books and say, wait a second, was this book teaching something correctly? Another problem was you didn't check out whether the verses substantiated what they say they substantiated. What is the teaching of the new demonology on generational demons? Yes?
The demon from the father, can you pass down from you or from your mother through a base?
I'm glad you added that second part. It makes me as a father feel well. By the way, when you come for orals, don't come telling me that the reason why Jesus didn't have a sin nature is because he didn't have a father, and the sin nature is passed on to the father. I don't want to hear it, you know. It's not biblical. Okay, and what do they base it upon?
What was that?
What do they base that teaching upon? Generational demons passed from the fathers, the parents, to the children.
From the law, or it's close to the law, it says that.
Specifically, anyone? Where do we find Exodus 20, verse
4 and 5.
Let's turn there and read the verse. Back.
Exodus 21.
20, verse 4.
You shall not make for yourself an idol of any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth.
And then, next verse.
You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am your jealous God, and visit in you the fathers of the children. I'm the third and the fourth generation of those who teach.
Here's what they teach. That the end result is God visits iniquity on the children. And they say that equals demons passed down. Now, what's the first question you should ask? Right. How does God doing something equal a demon being passed down? All right? How do they get that? Well, that's because their definition of iniquity equals demonic activity. What does iniquity mean? Specifically, what does the biblical word iniquity mean? What specific realm of sin does it mean? Wow.
In your heart.
Okay. The fact that you don't know this like this really concerns me. This is hamartiology. Iniquity is guilt. There's the realm of sin that's an activity. There's the realm of sin that's a state. I am a sinner. There is the realm of sin that has to do with trespass. I stepped across the known line. And then there is the realm of sin that's the consequence of sin, that is the guilt that you experience and the state of guilt that is between you and God. That's iniquity. Iniquity is guilt. Okay? It's guiltiness and guilt. They call it demonic activity. Why? Because earlier in the verse, it talked about idol worship. And to them, idol worship is demonic. Now do you see what happens with that foolish idea that all idols are demons? And that idol worship is being involved in demonic activity. You see where it leads. This all doctrine builds. Doctrine, remember we tried to show you with the doctrine of the church. One doctrine naturally leads to another, naturally leads to another. The same with false doctrine. They come down to this place where the Bible says God visits. God did do this. Hezekiah. God delivered the city of Jerusalem during the ministry of Isaiah. Hezekiah is so pumped up that he invites the Babylonians in to look at Jerusalem. At that time, the Babylonians were no threat. They themselves were a vassal state of Assyria. They themselves were fighting against Assyria. What's the problem? Well, the Babylonians came in, got a good look at the city, its treasury, and its stores, and they never forgot it. So when they overthrew the Assyrians, first thing they did is move to take over Jerusalem. So what God did is God said to Hezekiah, I am not going to punish you for this sin, but I'm going to bring punishment in the days of your children's children. You know what Hezekiah said? Yes, that's what he said. Okay. He said, fine, as long as it doesn't happen to me. It's like the ozone layer. Ah, who cares? You know, hairspray, got up there, you know. Let the ozone layer go apart. I got a beehive. It works. See the problem? The Bible teaches that in the Old Testament economy, when a generation sinned, generations after it pay for it. This is a general principle in life. When a baby is born, they put drops of poison in the eyes. Why? Why when a baby is born would they put poison in its eyes? By the way, how many of you knew they did that? Okay. You've not been parents. Because coming through the birth canal, the child can pick up syphilis. And if the child picks up syphilis in the eyes, it will blind him. There is no cure for syphilis. There is no cure for any kind of herpes. Herpes is a virus. There is no cure for any virus. None whatsoever. And so, a child, you don't get syphilis unless somebody has sinned. Now, you can get syphilis by somebody sinning against you. That is one of the problems with rape. By the way, if you don't know these things, there ought to be a class to teach you, because you'll learn about them in a hurry in the ministry. Deal with people. The first thing a rape victim has to do is get to the hospital, because there's a good chance they've contracted a sexually transmitted disease. That's a horrible crime. It's a crime of violence, but it's got lasting effects. So, a child that's blind could be blind, born blind, because one of the parents sinned. Remember in John, the question was asked, why is this child born blind? Which of its parents sinned? They recognized the phenomena back then. They didn't know everything about the medical details. But the only way you can get a sexually transmitted disease is to sleep with somebody other than a person who you're married to and who has not slept with anybody else. And by the way, that includes something that's not your sin, something like rape, correct? If you're a virgin, if you marry a virgin, or you marry a person who hasn't contracted disease and is faithful to you after you're married, you don't worry about sexually transmitted diseases. You with me? But that's a parent sin that causes the child to be blind. A mother who is addicted to something, the child will be addicted to it. There are children who are born, countless children are born heroin addicts. Meth, addicted to meth, which, by the way, is the leading drug problem in the United States. Crystal meth right now. I don't know if you knew that. It's not heroin, it's not cocaine, it's crystal meth. By the way, these are some things you got to get a little bit off the campus to know, you know, like the world. And I don't mean that this is a bad place. I just mean this is the reality of people that you talk to, the world they live in, the people you're trying to witness to. Okay, so are parents' sins visited upon the children? The answer, yes. But the Bible teaches something specific. God said, as part of the Mosaic Law, this is the law for Israel as a nation. I will make it a practice that when you sin, the effects of your sin will hurt others. Adam's sin not only affected his children, it affected the whole planet. You know, the reason why little fish get eaten by sharks is because of Adam's sin. Right? The reason why turtles get run over in the middle of the road, Adam's sin. The reason why trees get Japanese beetles and die, Adam's sin. Adam's sin affected vegetation, affected the planet, correct? Correct. Okay. Here's the problem, especially with using this verse. Look at Jeremiah chapter 31. When Jeremiah was talking about the new covenant to be made with the nation of Israel, you and I are benefactors of a covenant that wasn't made with us. The covenant was made with the nation of Israel. You and I are partakers of that covenant. The new covenant was established by Christ at the cross. Hebrews teaches that a person's will is put into effect by their death. Correct? That when a person dies, that's what puts their will into effect. The new covenant was established at the cross. Israel hasn't gotten the benefit of it yet, but it was established at the cross. The church is under the age of the new covenant, even though it wasn't made with us. But notice a very specific change between the old covenant, Mosaic Law, and the new covenant. Chapter 31, verse 29 and 30. By the way, first verse 27. Who's reading back there? Where are we?
Verse 27?
Yes.
Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and the seed of the beast.
Again, this has to be talking about Jews. Otherwise, they wouldn't refer to Israel and Judah. It has to be. No one ever says that we're the new Judah. You know, so this is talking about Israel. Keep going.
And so come to pass that as I have watched over them, plucked up and break down, overthrow, destroy, and bring harm, so I will watch over them to build and to plant, declares the Lord.
And if you studying, did your prophets, where have you seen that verse before? That's the key verse in the book of Jeremiah. It's part of Jeremiah's commissioning. Chapter 1, God says, it's going to take your whole lifetime, but I am going to pluck up and destroy and do all this, and then I'll rebuild. So this verse is a key verse. It's the verse that starts the book, and now in key places, three times it's used in the book. Now then, he says, verse 29 and 30.
In those days, it's no longer saying, fathers have eaten sour grapes, and children's teeth are set on edge. For everyone shall die from his own sin.
His own iniquity. That's the same word. Sin is a good translation, but it's more specific. It's the exact same word that's used in Exodus 20. Iniquity, okay?
Each man who eats sour grapes, his teeth shall be set on edge.
He says, under the new covenant, this specific provision is going to be done away with under the new covenant. So if there's any verse in the Bible that can't be used to talk about things happening today, it's Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 and 5. And it's used for a major doctrine. This is what the new demonology will do. When you are come to them for marriage counseling, they will have you fill out these long forms, identifying areas that you might have come across demonic activity and picked up a demon. So they'll ask, have you ever gotten involved with Ouija boards or Dungeons and Dragons or any video game that involved demons or witchcraft? Have you ever been drunk? Have you ever been involved in sexual immorality? Any one of these, you'll pick up a demon. Then they'll ask about your parents. Do you have a parent who's an alcoholic? Well, you could have that demon in your life. Do you have a parent with uncontrolled anger? That'll be a demon in your life. See the problem? You're passing down not sins to your children. You do that. If your parents have a tendency towards alcoholism, you will, both by nature and by nurture. Do you realize that most people who are alcoholics, I guess it's the figure's like 97% of all alcoholics have an alcoholic parent. And the figure is startling, somewhere around 2/3 of all alcoholics will have the majority of their children that are alcoholics. That means if one of your parents is an alcoholic, you have a great tendency towards that. Not only because it's something I think that may have to do with your weaknesses inside of you, sinfulness, it also is something you've observed. If one of your parents was an abuser, sexual or physical, you will do that. You have to fight. You say, no, I'll never do that. 100% of child abusers were abused when they were children. 100%. My sister, I guess I told you, she was involved in law enforcement, and one of the jobs she had was assistant attorney general, assistant district attorney for the city of St. Louis. She's that again. She now is involved with, she's got 17 district attorneys that work under her trying homicides. Before, she was involved in sexual crimes, child abuse. And she said, I'm telling you, there is no cure for sexual abuse. There is, and every time you see somebody who abuses children, you know they were abused. You know that. Sexual abuse. By the way, I say that, if no one else has said that to you, if you have been abused, you need to do something about it. You need to talk about it with someone. You need to talk about it with someone who's understanding and who knows how it works. Because it's not your problem. It's your continuing problem that you will pass down. It has hurt your psyche, it has hurt your self-identity, and it will hurt your marriage, and it will hurt your family. You cannot treat it, because what sexual abusers do is make their victims feel responsible for the crime. That's what people do with sexual abuse. They make the person they abuse feel guilty for the crime. Same with rape. They make that person feel guilty, and you need to get some help straightening that out. So there are sins and sinfulness that for one reason or another comes from parents to children. You will deal with this in your ministry. I'm telling you, if you haven't experienced it, and if it's not in your family, you have a rare family. And you will see it in your first year of ministry. You better know how to deal with it. You can't throw a couple verses at them and say, go memorize these. What if you think it's a demon? You're taking a person who's come to you, who's been poisoned, and you're acting as if they've got an attitude problem. See what I'm trying to say? You're taking a person who's got a bleeding gash and not treating it and not giving them antibiotics. If you are dealing with this new demonology, it is sick because the people who are coming to you are hurting. They're not coming to you because life is fine, they just have a few problems. They have problems they can't deal with, and somebody has told them that's a demon. That's sick because they're never going to fix what made them sick. So you are trying to say that these are important areas to deal with.
How far back does this passing on demons go? Because then, if that's true, then you go back all the way to Noah.
Exactly.
And then, like, how many
exactly
would we have?
That's what they say. They say you just go back and back and back. And it's undefined. It all depends on the particular proponent of new demonology, how far they'll take it.
Obviously, if the new demonology is continuing, they must think that something that they're doing in these type of counseling situations is working. So
yes.
What kind of results are they looking at and seeing and saying?
Well, anybody...
I mean, if they're not actually treating the problem.
I don't care whether you look at it as a demon or a sin, you are recognizing there's a problem in your life and trying to deal with it. If you're a Christian and you recognize a problem and you're actively working to deal with it, God will bless in some fashion. You won't be cured, but God blesses. That's our God. God always, always is merciful and does more. The only sins, in fact, every sin, even unrepentant sins, God deals with. Even if he has to use Satan. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 says what? When God won't use the church anymore, who does he use? Satan. But what does Satan deal with? In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, what is the realm that Satan deals with believers? Please read that. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Deliver such a one to Satan. For the, please read the rest of that verse. Who's next? Mike, you up the bat? First Corinthians chapter 5, I think it's verse 5.
You are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, so that the spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord.
See the point? The point is, Satan works on the flesh. It doesn't say he puts thoughts in your mind. It doesn't say that Satan caused the sin. Many of you pointed this out. Where in the world, when somebody was confronted with demonic activity, did they rebuke the person? They didn't rebuke the person, they rebuked the demon. So now new demonology changes it and says, through all of their ways of turning things around, and they say, no, it's your problem. By the way, what are the clear signs of demonic activity in a person's life in the Gospels? People who are demon-possessed. How did you know that? Physical affliction, they foamed at the mouth, they threw themselves, they harmed themselves, and did all kinds of stuff. By the way, just because you harm yourself doesn't mean there's demonic activity. In the last 3 years, it's died down, but up to about 2 years ago, cutting, especially among women, was a serious problem on our campus as well as other places. That's a phenomenon that has to do with deep psychological problems. If you attribute that to a demon, you're never going to get at the problem that causes a person to cut themselves. Okay? And if you don't understand the phenomena, how are you going to deal with it? What do you think about the Christian parents who didn't know how to deal with it when your Christian children, nice kids, were doing this? See the problems here? You've got to recognize that poor, weak doctrine ends up with believers who cannot deal with their sins, who are not practicing sanctification, as Paul listed it, and churches. Once this gets into a church, it comes in usually through counseling. The number one area that this comes in through counseling. And once it gets into a church, it becomes the focus of everything. I know churches involved in this, but every time they have an evangelistic meeting for demons, they go through the church and bind demons from the rooms because people might have left a demon behind. You know, like, you leave your bulletins on the pews. Who knows? You might have left the demon of alcoholism there, and poor Aunt Sadie, the pianist, sits down, and tomorrow, you know. You know what I'm saying? It's like, what? Churches send their youth pastors to the homes of the youth to bind demons and to protect them from demons. So it's like Ali Ali Allin for you, you know? You run in there, and I'm in the house. Whew. Demons inhabiting cars. I don't know. Maybe you have to speak Japanese if it's a monster, you know? You know, it's like, what in the world are we talking about? How do we get to this place? We get to this place by well-meaning people with more theology. People, what we're talking about in this class, whether it's the doctrine of the church, angelology, saintology, the point is poor doctrine corrupts what you do. That what you do is based on what you believe. And if what you believe is unsound, at some point it will show up. Grab this from you. It might be not. That's not very safe, is it? That's even less safe, right? I don't know if I can do this or not. No, that's worrying you. No, I'm just standing on a chair like 2 foot from the ground. Guys, you want to do this spiritually? You're nervous, you can't look, right? I got legs like a stork and I could kill myself. See, what if I'm doing this? See, I'm trying. If I were him, I'd be worried. But you watch somebody doing this with doctrine and somebody says, that's just doctrine. That's just doctrine. Doctrine is the basis for all your actions. What you believe is how you act. And when you've got poor doctrine, weak doctrine, it doesn't hurt you when you're sitting in it, usually. See what I'm trying to say? Guys, you've got to learn to look at doctrine that way. That is why all those comments on your papers. Not because it was like, you did this wrong, you did this wrong, you did this wrong. It's because you were not thinking doctrinally. You were not going back and looking at it from a doctrinal framework. The problem in this class is you don't get that framework till you leave class. You've been working on this, some of you since January, some of you since the beginning of April. All right? I've been getting covered for some of the work that I saw. But I want you leaving class thinking that way. Two things. One, I need you to hand in your outline, your summaries for the three doctrines together, soul liberty, autonomy, separation. Second, I need you next class period to bring the folder, or to bring, excuse me, all of your summaries that were handed back to you. I need all of them. So bring them to class, we'll put those in your folder, and then we will return them to you at the end of next week. But I need to look at all of them myself. I've got to look at every one of your summaries. And don't worry about the grades and summaries. I'll take care of the grades. That was my problem in assigning people to grade and not making the grades seem clear. Don't worry about the grades for your summaries. What I care about is, did you learn to do a summary, and did you learn to write that? Okay. Hand back your outlines. I need them. The grades haven't been